Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, GMOs have had attention for so many years, I can't even keep track of it now. But one of the people that keeps getting drawn into those conversations about GMOs, and also even broader into what's coming after GMOs, is Dr. Allison Van Eneman at UC Davis. And Allison's been on Farm to Table Talk before, and I'm happy to welcome you back again, Allison.
Well, thanks for the invite.
Are you getting tired of getting beat up on this issue? I mean, it just seems like I've heard you time and again in discussions and debates and interviews and so forth, and the critics of GMO just really kind of go after you because you're standing up and you'll explain things. But I would imagine you get a little weary of that battle.
Well, I guess for me, I get a little weary of the debate around the safety of genetic engineering because I really think the science is very solid on that. And I've been basically saying what the science says for 20 years now. And there's just such a kind of a confirmation bias or a bubble around people that think it's dangerous that there's no way that any kind of information can filter in. And that's frustrating, but I don't believe that's the majority of people. And so I guess my interest is trying to communicate this technology to just the average consumer because I do think it's a breeding method that has a lot of potential uses. And basically this political discourse is preventing scientists from using it to improve our plants and animals. And that's really where my passion is and what my research and career is dedicated to, is trying to use genetics to solve problems of agriculture.
Well, let's just touch briefly on one of the things we're kind of evolving through on concerns that some people have had on GMOs is that they felt that because a plant could be resistant to using a product like Roundup on it, that it would have, and in some cases has led to more use of that pesticide. And so in their cases, they were just fearful that more pesticides were coming into the world. The irony on that issue is that other products are coming on because Roundup there is more resistance to Roundup, for example. But there seems to be one group that's been the area that they've been concerned about.
Right, and I mean, there's legitimate concerns there, right? And so I don't want to kind of dismiss those. I think the point I like to make is that this is a breeding method that can get used for many different purposes. So when you're talking about the disease-resistant papaya in Hawaii, that's got nothing to do with Roundup or Monsanto, for that matter. It's a publicly developed application, and I work in animal breeding, and we don't, you know, we don't have Roundup-resistant cows. And so, yes, that's a concern, but I think it's also a concern that can be associated with the use of any pesticide on any plant. And so it doesn't have to be a GMO plant. There are, herbicide-resistant plants that have been developed using mutation breeding. And no one seems to worry about the resistance to the ALS herbicides that are used on those. And so we kind of conflate the breeding method as being this is the cause of all evil, when in fact, if you tease it apart, it's really that particular application that has the potential to lead to resistance. And of course, integrated pest management is a better way to approach it than using one particular pesticide, the same way you don't use a single antibiotic all the time in human medicine, or you'll develop bacteria that are resistant to that that antibiotic.
So the science keeps moving on, and there seems to be, you know, we've talked about genetic engineering now for what, Allison, has it been over 20 years, 30 years?
Yeah. Well, science has been doing it for 30 years. The first commercialized crop came onto the market in 1996, so it's 20 years. It was actually, Flavor Saver was a year before that, but in terms of row crops, it was 1996. So 20 years we've been growing it, and we now have 20 years of data on safety and environmental impacts. And I think if you look, there's a very good safety record, and actually the impact has been a dramatic reduction in the use of harmful pesticides, both organophosphate insecticides and more dangerous and toxic herbicides. So that fact rarely gets mentioned in the media, but it's well documented. That's why 18 million farmers use it, right?
Well, and then the technology keeps marching on. I mean, science doesn't stand still. And there's been some talk lately about CRISPR, which people are beginning to scratch their head. And, you know, that just sounds like the way you describe ideal fruit, I guess, that it's crisper than normal. But could you explain what is that in layman's terms?
Yeah, so CRISPR is one of a suite of tools that can make precise double-stranded breaks in DNA. And it can be used to very precisely introduce desired genetics into plants and animals. And so basically it gives you the ability, for example, to turn off a protein that might be making a plant or an animal susceptible to disease. And so they've used it to turn off a protein in pigs that makes it resistible to the PRRS virus. Or you could potentially do something like introduce the allele from Angus, which don't grow horns, into Holstein, which do, and we've actually worked with a company doing that, to produce Holsteins that don't grow horns, because they're actually carrying the form of the gene, the allele, that prevents horns from growing. That's a naturally occurring allele. It's no different to what you find in Angus, but we've just introduced it into a different breed to give that breed the hornless phenotype.
Let's stop right there for a second, because I think when you talk about horns, I mean, most people can guess why you would just assume not have horns on your livestock. I mean, they can horn each other, or, you know, or they can, the humans, they're harder to handle and so forth. So it's been the practice to dehorn. And then the people that are concerned about how animals are treated have objected, because they think when you dehorn an animal, you're causing pain, and so obviously you would like to cause as less pain to animals. And so what you're able to do sort of in the lab, and I'm kind of rushing all through this, is that, what, like you said, make it so those cattle don't have horns in the first place.
Right. We're basically genetically tweaking the gene that grows horns so it no longer does that, turning off the horn gene, if you will. And so the animals are still got all the excellent dairy genetics, but they no longer grow horns. And so we've used genetics to solve a problem of agriculture, which is what I like to do.
would that be technically still a GMO? Is that genetic engineering?
That's a really interesting question. So, you know, we haven't introduced any novel DNA. So it's not like, I don't know, putting a tomato gene in a fish or something, like, which is what some people object to genetic engineering about. What we're really doing here is working within the DNA of a species to introduce desired genetics that doesn't introduce novel DNA from outside that species. And so the USDA, as it relates to plants, has suggested that's not a GMO, whereas the FDA, which regulates genetically engineered animals, has suggested that if the modification was intended by humans, then that modification is a drug, and the animal is a new animal drug, which is kind of bizarre, because they're kind of saying DNA is a drug, and we all carry DNA, right? That our entire genome is DNA. And so it's basically saying that if humans are using this particular technology, it's going to be regulated as a drug, even though there's really no new risks associated with that particular phenotype of not having horns, because we've been eating that for years when we eat Angus cattle, for example.
Sure.
It doesn't seem to be very risk-based. It seems to be more kind of ideologically based on whether human intention was involved with the modification. And that's kind of the antithesis of a science-based regulatory review, because what does human intention have to do with risk?
Yeah. Well, I suppose it could have done it backwards. If there's any reason that we wanted to have horns, you could probably get horns back in Angus, you know, if you...
Well, I think the Angus Association would not be too...
No, they would...
Conceptually, we could do that. And basically what this enables us to do is, if we've got a breed that's particularly well-suited to a particular environment, dairy or beef, and we want to introduce a trait that we know what the gene is in another breed, we can bring it in without having to crossbreed them and bring along the other half of the genetics of that breed that would come if you mated, for example, an Angus bull with a Holstein cow. Yes, you'd get a polled animal, but it would be kind of a half Holsteiny, half Angusy, beefy, dairy thing. So you don't want to do that, because you're bringing in, you know, half the genome of the Angus animal. You just want that one allele at that one loci or one gene that turns off horns. And so it's much more precise than crossbreeding, And that's, I like to say it's precision breeding, because that's really what it is. It enables us to precisely bring in the alleles that we want.
So I got a question for you, and this is a tough question. I don't know if you can give me a simple answer, but if you're going to flip the switch, I mean, what's involved? I mean, are you taking cells and putting them under a microscope and using some equipment to actually literally like flip a switch in the DNA?
So say we're using CRISPR. CRISPR is a protein, and it can be directed to cut at the horns gene, for example. And in the case of the cows, we're doing this in cells, and we want to then bring in the allele from Angus and then kind of do it what's called an interspecies allele substitution, which is just a fancy way of saying we basically put the allele that doesn't grow horns into the cell. In the case of the bulls we worked with, that cell was then cloned, but what a lot of researchers are working on now is to edit the next generation at the embryo stage so that you can basically use conventional breeding programs to select the very best genetics and then put a cherry on top by making it polled or changing the coat color or maybe a disease resistance loci. So it won't replace traditional breeding. It really just enables us to very precisely introduce some tweaks that we would like in there to make that animal better suited or disease resistance or whatever the trait is that we're introducing.
But what's the target material? I mean, is this, again, something that's in a petri dish, or is this an injection into the embryo?
So developing embryos, in the case where you fertilize the egg with the sperm, that's day zero, and then we do embryo transfer with cattle at day seven, and so you're editing that embryo and then doing basically embryo transfer into a surrogate cow who then goes through pregnancy for 9 months and gives birth to the animal that is carrying that edit. So we still have to use, good old gestation to get the calf out, but we are basically tweaking it right at the very beginning of the embryo development.
When you say tweaking, though, I mean, isn't like some tiny scalpel or a hypodermic needle?
You're actually injecting the protein, the CRISPR or whatever the nuclease is, into the developing embryo, and at the one cell stage it will go in and target the DNA in the genome that you want it to target, so in this case horns, and then you'll integrate or swap in the allele that you want, in this case the allele that doesn't grow horns, and then it does that replacement, and then it divides and divides and divides and divides and becomes a cow. So basically you want to try and get it at that one cell stage to make the edit, and then it grows as normal, and every cell from then on is going to carry that edit.
So if that wasn't a cow you got a bull, that bull you could produce sperm and breed it with other Holsteins, and they're naturally polled, and you didn't have to insert a beef breed to be able to...
Right, and so we've actually done that. So now we have 6 pregnancies from these Holstein bulls without horns, and we hypothesize as scientists that they won't grow horns because it's a dominant trait, and those calves are due in September, and so we'll see. It'll be a pretty obvious phenotype, do they grow horns or not. We're actually doing the science and then having a look at whether there's any off-target effects or any unexpected or changes, but that's basically what we're doing at the research stage of this project.
Well, I would think this is something that people that are supporters of animal welfare issues and others should applaud if they weren't naturally suspicious of science and they can overcome that.
Well, like I say, it's using a genetic approach to address an animal welfare problem, which is better than burning the horns off, which we currently do, in my opinion. Other people may have different opinions, but at least let's have that discussion and get away from kind of more traditional arguments about GMOs and have a look at some different applications that really, in this case, benefit the animal. And that really changes the discussion, and hopefully we can have a more, nuanced public discourse around this technology than has been the case for the last 20 years with the GMO debate.
Well, and then one other thing I have to add to this discussion is why they're still deciding on whether or not this is genetic engineering, depending on its how FDA sees it or how USDA sees it. Given the fact that we now have this GMO labeling law that is pending implementation, companies that would use milk or cheese from these might have to say that produce with genetically engineered milk, possibly. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, so, you know, is this genetic engineering or not? Well, genetic engineering is defined by having a recombinant DNA construct in the animal. In this case, we don't. It's the cow DNA, right? So is it or is it not genetic engineering? And unfortunately, the GMO expression, you know, it doesn't mean anything. So genetically Right. modified doesn't really... So, you know, yes, they're genetically modified. So is a chicken and a chihuahua relative to their ancestors, right? And so sure. I think that's a very misleading term. And as a scientist, I'd rather use precise language. And genetic engineering has traditionally meant the use of recombinant DNA technology to introduce a gene like the BT gene into corn or whatever. That's coming from a different species or even kingdom. Now we're talking about doing tweaks within an animal's own DNA, which is really analogous to breeding, right? We're selecting right. genetic variants that we want, be they, you know, I don't know, double muscle animals or whatever. And so we're really working with nature's variation and very the very basis of evolution, right, is how breeders are operating. So we're introducing some novel DNA or novel variation into the animal in the same way that nature does that. And so does that make it more or less acceptable? And is it genetic engineering if that's the case? And those questions, I think, we're in the middle of wrestling with. And the jury's not out yet. But I guess my point is it can be used for really useful things like disease-resistant animals. And let's be careful not to just arbitrarily preclude the use of a technology that has a lot of uses without thoroughly thinking through the opportunity costs of forbidding geneticists from using that technology.
Well, I think I do have to ask you one little question to back up, because there's somebody out there listening to this that's scratching their head and saying, wait a minute, I'm not quite sure I know what recombinant DNA means. Can you, what's a simple explanation?
Well, so recombinant DNA is basically a term that's used to describe the use of enzymes to put together DNA in a recombinant, so recombining it. So typically in old-fashioned genetic engineering from, you know, 20 years ago, you introduced a segment of DNA where you've added a promoter to a gene that is kind of not found in nature,
oh,
and you've
right.
introduced that into, you've used recombinant DNA technologies, which is basically molecular biology, to produce that particular sequence of DNA, and then you've introduced that into the organism of interest. And that might be in the case of BT, it's a BT protein being driven by some on switch that turns it on in the plant. So that's you can do a test for that. You can identify it as being there. It's not normally found in that animal. It's very distinguishable from a plant that doesn't carry that.
That's when the critics used to start saying frankenfood and things like that.
And it's the PCR can detect that. What we're talking about with editing quite often is changes that are not detectable because there's no new introduced DNA, and it's exactly the same sequence as occurs in, you know, Angus, for example. And so there's not going to be, it's going to be literally indistinguishable other than the fact that one was produced using human intent and one was produced using selection on just randomly occurring mutations. And the question is, you know, we can't tell the difference. We only have kind of that, I don't know, moral taint of having human intent behind it. How do you go about regulating something that you can't even detect because it's exactly the same?
You know what? I mean, it's an exciting area. And I guess the next challenge is that in some respects, it's almost like being able to go back two decades and say, gee, if you could have started all over with these discussions on GMO, how do you create a basis of trust among the public that you know, worries about new technologies? And we're kind of on the cusp of this new frontier of gene editing that'll apply to lots of foods and plants and animals. And do you have any suggestions on how we kind of learn from what we've gone through in the past and try to have people, you know, be more understanding and, you know, less suspicious about some of this, the evolution of the science?
So, yeah, I mean, I do have some suggestions, because for 20 years we've been spectacularly unsuccessful. So let's not keep doing what we've been doing for the last 20 years, which is trying to hammer people over the head with science and trying to correct their misinformation, right? And so I think a much more effective scientific communication strategy, if you look at the social science around this, is to explain not how we're doing things, but why we're doing things, and especially things that kind of equate to many people's concerns. And so I think most people want us not to be doing painful procedures to animals. I think most people don't want animals getting sick. And so there's a genetic approach to making disease-resistant animals or preventing a painful procedure. Then we can have a discussion around, if you use it, then this. And if you don't use it, there's actually the result of doing nothing is you continue to have these unpleasant things happening. And so maybe we can have a different discussion. And I would argue that some of these applications really align with many people's kind of core values. And hopefully we can discuss why we're doing these things and how it could help, and then have a respectful discussion around, well, should we? And if we don't, then what are the consequences of not allowing the technology?
Well, Allison, I think you've given us a good start on this conversation today. And I can, as you were explaining what would be the ideal, I not only see more podcasts, but to me, a podcast is a kind of simply a poor substitute for actually being around a literal table. I call it farm-to-table talk because I feel like there needs to be more table talk. I mean, I think one thing that would work is that if I could have you sit down with three or four people at a time, but there's a lot of population to work through.
How many years is that going to take exactly?
Well, take the rest of your career, I'm afraid.
And that's, you know, I think the important thing is trying to speak to just the general public, because often we kind of hear either ends of the extremists, you know, the antis and the companies, and really there's a very large group in the middle, I think, that maybe are not getting targeted, and how do we best get that message out to just, you know, my mum, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think, a challenge for scientific communication, is to speak in a way that's comprehensible to the general public and compelling to their shared values around agriculture.
Where do you tell your mom to look for information?
Actually, my mum's pretty sharp. She's of the generation that still reads newspapers, but she's pretty on top of it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, those people that are listening that aren't your mom, that aren't related to you, any place in particular? I mean, you have a website that they can do some more of their own research, or
So, you know, this is an interesting question at this juncture in our history, especially with regards to social media and quote unquote fake news, although that term's getting old quickly. I guess, you know, as someone that has a respect for the kind of the weight of evidence around scientific topics, whether it be vaccines or climate change or GMOs, these politicized topics, I go to the kind of the consensus statements of the big scientific organizations, AAAS or the National Academy of Science, because there you've got basically, you know, independent scientists that have reviewed all of the literature, not just one study or one, you know, red herring, and come to a deliberative consensus around what the data says. And so that would be my suggestion, is go for meta-analyses and consensus statements of scientific organizations, rather than, you know, some of the more sensational sites that come up with claims that aren't verified by data or the scientific literature.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to help explain a lot of this, and I think that these are areas that are exciting, and I think people should watch for you speaking on this more often, and I'm sure you'll be showing up on conversations on other media, and just thanks for taking the time to talking to us today on Farm to Table Talk.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.